Okay, good morning. We had a good long weekend. Just get down the names of the people with cameras on. Okay, let's see. So my plan for today is to look a little bit more at the mean value theorem, and in particular, what it tells us about functions. And I guess I'll do a little bit more of that on Friday, but mostly most of that will happen today. Two main facts that I want to explore about functions. So using the mean value theorem, to figure out facts about these various classes of functions that we've been looking at. To understand functions. And of course, what we care about is these differentiable functions. And also derivatives. So differentiable functions I've been calling D1, and derivatives I've been calling D0. So just they have names. Okay, and so the comparison that I want to start with is the intermediate value theorem. And the thing you want to do is compare what you saw in 127A. So 127A information. And there, instead of studying differential, you studied continuous functions. Okay, so information about the images of continuous functions. And continuous functions are going by the name of C1 in this class. C0, continuous. C1 would be one times differentiable and continuous. And what we get for just differentiable functions or just derivatives. Those are derivatives. And those are what we're calling D0, so functions that are derivatives. And the type of examples to bear in mind where we saw some differences are things like the function, let me call it G2, I think that's one of the names it got. So let me call a G2 of X, this function that came up in the homework several times, and it's a good one to produce examples. So it was just x squared sine of 1 over x, which doesn't make sense, of course, at 0, but except at 0, and just make it equal to 0 at 0. So that function, and let's see, so does anyone remember what class of function this is? So remember, the interesting thing in this course is just how differentiable everything is. And so with this one, do people remember, is this differentiable? It is in fact a differentiable, which someone may have said in the chat, but I can't see the chat. Okay, there I got the chat. Yes, and it does say correctly in the chat that this is a D1, which is correct. That's where it lives. So this is in D1 of the reals. And what we saw earlier was that in particular, those are contained in the continuous function. So this is a continuous function, all right? So it's gonna satisfy all the properties of continuous function. But since it's in D1, we can also take its derivative, and that turned out to be the more interesting example for us, because its derivative, of course, it's a derivative. So by definition, it's in the class of derivatives, but it's no longer continuous. So we have 2x sine of 1 on x minus cosine of 1 on x and 0. Turns out to be its derivative, which we compute it already. And so this is a different derivative, but it's not a continuous function, right? So this is the classic example we want to keep in mind. All right, and so let me just summarize two facts that you had about the images of continuous functions back from last term, and compare that to what's true for derivatives. So let me just recall the numbers of those theorems. So let's see, so today let me take, consider the setting with a less than c less than d less than b. And I'll typically look for functions defined on the open interval a, b, and then restrict them to the closed interval c, d. So let me write, if f is some function defined on the open interval a, b, then the image im of f restricted to cd just means all the values that the function takes if x is between c and d. So it's a set of all f of x such that c is less than or equal to x, which is less than or equal to d. And it's those images that I want to study. Okay, I want to see what are the set of values that my function takes. Okay, and so the two theorems that I want to recall from last term, let's see, so one of them, I guess it's 7.35. Okay, and so it says that whenever I have a function which is continuous, because that's the class that you studied last term on this bigger interval AB, then we have that if I look at the image of the restriction to this closed interval, actually, can anyone tell me what you know about the image of the restriction to a closed interval of a continuous function? So if I take a continuous function on a closed interval, so from C to D, a compact set, what do you know about the image of that? So, so again, there's a continuous function on this compact set here, C to D, including the endpoints. Okay, so let me write down a few facts. Hopefully they'll be familiar. Yes, it has a maximum and a minimum. That's one of the most important facts, exactly. Right, and I'm gonna summarize. It's continuous isn't quite the right term, but it does have, it's connected, which is maybe what you're thinking of there. So the set's connected. Let me write it in two different pieces. One coming from this 7.35, which gives this maximum minimum. And this is that it's a closed and bounded. Okay, so closed and bounded. So that's one fact. I feel like I'm writing kind of small. I hope people can see that. But anyway, so, and then the other theorem is 7.44. Let me write this IVP for intermediate value property. And that says that we have the same class of functions and we have this image is connected. Okay, so the upshot is that hence this image, the set of values that this function takes when I plug in x's between c and d is exactly a closed interval from the f at this minimum, like you said exists, to f at this maximum, which you have is a closed interval. Or I guess it could be that the maximum are the same, in that case, it's just a single point or a point. Okay, so that's what you learned previously? Is it the only possibility is that it's just a line segment and both endpoints are there. So there is a maximum and a minimum, okay? And now I want to compare that to what we can say for functions which are derivatives. Okay, so write down the new theorem. So this is old here. And so now we have a new theorem. Okay, and one of the key things is still true and the other one isn't. Okay, so that's what happens is that we keep one of these properties, but not both. All right, so the first one fails now. So there exists, so A here, there exists now functions F in the continuous, not continuous, now the derivatives, so D0 of AB, with this image being not bounded. And B, there exist ones with the image not closed. Okay, so both of those problems can occur. But the main theorem is that the last one, the intermediate value property, still holds. Okay, so C, and this is Darboux's theorem, this intermediate value property still holds. So for every F in not just C0 now, but D0, that's the only thing that's going to change in this whole thing. We have that the image of F is connected. Okay, so that's the class of properties that that's what's still true and what's no longer true. Okay, so let me just indicate a couple of things that follow from this before going on to the proof. So first some examples and then the proof. Of this Darboux theorem, I think I'll leave A and B as homework problems. Okay, so I'll give you some examples that you can check that on for homework. Okay, but let me start with some examples, some corollaries, some things that follow from part C here. So using C, if the image has just two elements, then of course it can't be connected. So if the image of F are restricted to C and D has exactly two values, then it's not connected. So this function F is not a derivative. And we had some examples like that. There were questions from earlier that asked that. And so, e.g., if I take a function like, let me just graph this thing, right? That's a function that takes on exactly two values. This is not a derivative. So this is equal to the function that's say one if x is bigger than zero and zero if x is less than or equal to zero. And this is not a derivative. Okay, so this is one example. Similarly, if I take the function that's just one at zero and zero everywhere else, for the same reason, this is not a derivative. Okay, so these are some functions that we can see cannot be derivatives by using this theorem. Let me give a sort of a nice corollary of that. So a corollary. Let's say that I have two functions and I want them, and they're both derivatives, okay? And they just differ at one point. What can I say about those functions? So a corollary, if f and g are derivatives, and except for some value, let's say e, so for all x different from e, we have f of x equals g of x, then I claim that f of e equals g of e also. Okay, so they can't just differ in one point. Actually, can anyone see how I could prove that? Let me at least get started, and then you can see if you can figure out how to continue. So I'm trying to prove that they're equal. Let's assume they're not, and try to get a contradiction. So for contradiction, assume that f of v is different from f of g. I'm sorry, f of v is different from g of v, like so. Okay, then, all right, so how am I gonna get a contradiction? So can anyone see that?
Probably wanna use limits.
Limits are a good approach.
And show like to be differentiable, you need the limits to be the same.
You need the limits to be the same. That's one possible approach, but I claim that I have an easier one now because I observed over here if I have a function with exactly two values, then that's not differentiable. How can I use these two functions here that differ just in one place to build a function that has exactly two values? That's mostly zero, except at one point. Does that make sense? Yeah, someone has written it in the chat. If I look at the difference between these two functions, right? What are the what values is the difference of those two functions take?
It'll be zero everywhere except at e.
Exactly, and it's not zero at e because they're different, right? So it's got exactly two values. It's got zero and whatever their difference happens to be, which is different from zero, right? So it's got exactly two values. And that's exactly the sort of thing we just said is not a derivative. Okay. F minus g is in D0, since D0 is a vector space, but we can just compute it, f minus g evaluated at x is, as you just said, it's at zero most of the time whenever x is different from e, and it's f of e minus g of e, which is not zero, when x is equal to e. So this is not zero here. Okay, so it has exactly two values, and we just showed that that's not a derivative. Right, because I have both that it's not in D0 and that it isn't D0. So that's my contradiction. Okay, so it says that whenever I have a function that's where they just differ at one point, then I know that. So e.g., if I take this function that I, let's see, where did I put it? I guess it's up here. If I take my g2 prime, and just change it at one point, I have a function that might still satisfy the intermediate value property, but is no longer a derivative. Okay, so e.g., if I take the function and I just change g2 prime at one point, so I'm going to take exactly what I had there, so g2 prime, so 2x sine 1 on x minus cosine 1 on x, just like it was going to be g2 prime. But then I make it say a half here at 0. This is not a derivative. Okay. Even though it satisfies the intermediate value problem, and the fact that it does will be a homework problem. Even though, satisfies the intermediate value property. Okay, this intermediate value property, the image is connected. Okay, so that's a little bit of an intuition that follows from this theorem of Darboux. Okay, any questions about the statement? And then I'll go to proving this theorem. Okay. So the proof of Darboux theorem. Right, so the thing that I called C. All right, so the first thing to notice is that I can restate it in a way that looks a little bit more like the way the text does. So to say that this is connected is the same as saying that if I have two values, f of C and f of D, and I have some point, so this is a f of C here, and this is f of D, and I have a point alpha, which is between them, then this is also equal to f of something. Okay, that's what it means for it to be connected, right? This one in between is also that value. So that's another way to write it, and that's going to be an easier way in which to prove it. So let me write it out that way. So equivalently, we have the following. If we have our hypotheses as before, so if A is less than C is less than, that's way too small. A is less than C is less than D is less than B, right? Just like we had before. And we have our function F in the differentiable function, the derivatives on AB. F of x is equal to the derivative of something, let me call it capital F, okay, just so I have another name for it, with capital F having one derivative, okay, so we're in this setting, it's the same thing, right? In fact, capital F is almost unique, right? We proved that last time. There's only one choice of capital F up to a constant, up to a global constant. Okay, but anyway, so there is such a thing. So now if I have alpha lying between capital F prime and of C and capital F prime of D, then it's equal to capital F prime of something else. And if alpha is between capital F prime, that's the same as little f evaluated at C, and capital F prime, again, that's little f evaluated at D, then there is E between C and D with capital F prime, again, that's little f evaluated at E equals alpha. So that's the same statement. So any question about that statement? It's a longer way to say it. It's the way it's written out in the book, and it's the easier one to prove. To me, this version where the image is connected is a little bit more intuitive to work with, but they are equivalent. Okay, question about that. So again, if we have these two values that are achieved and we have some alpha that's in between, then that's also achieved. That's what that's telling us. Okay, so let's try to prove that. And so I will assume that we have this set up. All right. So in this case, okay, so there are two possibilities for this between, and let me just decide which one, and I'll just prove one of them and not the other. So so one, it could be that f prime of c is less than alpha, which is less than f prime of d, or two, the other way around. So we have the inequalities the other way. So those are the two possibilities. And let's see, I will do this one below. Consider this case. And this one is very similar. Okay, so I'm just gonna look at one of those two just for convenience, all right? Okay, the next thing to do is to eliminate alpha. And the easiest way to do that is to write capital G to be capital F tilted so that the alpha becomes zero. So I'm gonna subtract alpha times X. Okay, so I'm just gonna tilt my function, okay, to get rid of that alpha. What does that mean? So in case two, which is the one that I'm gonna study here, that says, we are this way. So G prime of X, of course, is just F prime of X. Prime of X minus alpha, right? Because we know how to differentiate X. Okay, so we just shifted everything down by alpha. And so then I have that G prime of X, of C rather, is greater than, now I subtract alpha from alpha, so I just get zero, which is greater than G prime of D. Okay, so that's the situation we're in. And if I just draw a little sketch of what that looks like, which I usually like to do, that says that over here at C, I have that the derivative of G is positive. And over here at D, I have that the derivative is negative. Okay, and in between it does something. And what I, and is it clear what I would like? So the goal now is to find this E and is it clear what value I want the derivative of G to have? So it's sort of tracking through the logic of where we are. Okay. So I want F prime at E to be alpha, right? And I twisted my function by this alpha here, right? So what do I want G prime at E to be? Right, okay, yeah, so a couple people have seen it. That's right, so hopefully, that is a matter of tracking through everything I've written. So once you catch up to where it is, then it should be clear that the value that I'm looking for is zero, right? So I want something which is horizontal, a derivative of zero. Okay, and how do I get derivatives that are zero? We have some methods of doing that. Right, so I want to find some E in the middle here where the derivative here is zero. So can anyone see what would be a good choice to try for my E here? Yeah, that's right. Okay. Does that make sense, everyone? So so we have to kind of remember where everything is now. So this function g, so f was itself differentiable and therefore continuous. We, here it is. F was itself differentiable and therefore continuous. We added something continuous to it or subtracted something continuous from it. So this is again a continuous function. Okay, it's on this closed interval. Okay, and so it has a maximum, it's at some point, capital M, it has some maximum. And as suggested, we want to take E to be that point at which our function takes its maximum value, right? And then we have this theorem, Fermat, the internal maximum theorem that says that if our function takes an extremum in the middle here, then we get a derivative of zero, and that's what we want, okay? So then we're almost done. All right, so let me just write that up. So, okay, since F is differentiable and hence continuous, so is G. And by 7.37, which is the corollary of 7.35, we have M in this interval between S, C, and D with G equal to the maximum of its image. Okay, so we have this value M. Okay, and I came, there are three possibilities for where that M lies. So case A, we call it case A, M is in the interior. Okay, if that's true, then we're done, right? So hence by, the internal maximum theorem, as I just mentioned, internal, I guess what we call the internal extremum theorem, which has a number here. Okay. We have G prime of M is equal to zero. So take E equals M and we're done. Okay, but of course there are two other cases. It could be at those endpoints. So case C, M is equal to C, and case D, M is equal to D. Okay, and these of course are similar. I'll just do one of them. So, so consider this one. And this one, of course, is similar. Okay, and now can anyone see what is gonna happen here? So if I take, if this is my maximum value, well, the way I sketched it can C possibly be the maximum value here. Can C possibly where it be equal to M, where it takes its maximum?
No.
Right, it cannot, because it's got a positive derivative, right? And so when I look nearby, I'm going to find something that's bigger. And that's what I need to prove, and then I'll be done, okay? So I'm going to prove that, in fact, C is not M, okay? Because I'm going to find an X at which my function takes a larger value, all right? So consider in this case. So we'll show that this is not possible. By finding an X with the value of my function capital G of X being strictly bigger than capital G of the endpoint, which we were claiming was M. Okay, and so that's a contradiction. contradicting the choice of n. Okay, so again, we have, g of m is supposed to be the maximum here, and here it's not. Okay, so that's the contradiction. Okay, so that's all we have to do now is to find this x that satisfies this property. And we can see from the picture how to do that, right? It should be just very close. I look very close here to see, and it's going to be bigger. All right, so I just have to write out that formally, and then I'll be done. All right. Okay, so in case C, summarizing where we are here, in this case, M equals C. Okay, so we can just compute. All right, and so we have that. When I look up here, I have that the derivative of g at c here is bigger than zero. So let me just write that down. So I have zero is less than g prime at c. And what is the derivative at zero? That's the limit as x approaches c of the difference quotient, g of x minus g of c divided by x minus c. Okay, and the goal, of course, is to make this, so we want this positive. Okay, actually, this limit is the same as the limit from the right and the limit from the left. I'm only interested in the right-hand side. So let me just note that this is actually, I can just put in a plus here and it's still true, right? So this is, I can just stick in a plus and it's still true, right? So the limit is the same as the limit from the right and is the same as the limit from the left. I only care about the limit from the right. So that's what I'm going to study, all right? Let me do that. So if I'm taking the limit from the right here, what do I know about the sign of the denominator? Which I've just kind of obscured. But anyway, here this denominator, x minus c. That's right, so this is positive. This is positive. So all I need is that this is positive, and that's very plausible, right? So let me just write it out formally, but that's exactly what you would expect, right? Okay, so let me just write that out. For all epsilon greater than zero, there exists a delta greater than, I left a little space there. I can also take delta to be smaller than something if I like. Let me take it to be less than d minus c, just so I don't run off the edge. So I have this delta bigger than zero, but I'll take one smaller than d minus c. And so then we know that for every x value that we take bigger than c, and less than a c plus delta, because we're only looking at from the right here, right? So just on the right-hand side. Then we have, down here, so we have that the difference between the limit, which is supposed to be this g prime of c here, and the thing we're taking the limit of is difference quotient. So g of x minus g of c divided by x minus c is less than epsilon. I mean, it's also bigger than minus epsilon, but this is the case that this is the side of that inequality that I care about. Okay, so this much is true. Okay, so that's just the definition of a limit. And now I get to choose my favorite epsilon, and this is going to be true, right? And so let me do that. So choose epsilon equals, say, a half of g prime of c. And we know that this is bigger than zero because g prime of c is bigger than zero, okay? And then I just plug it in and I get what I wanted. Okay, so I'm gonna plug in half and I'll subtract from both sides. So I get one minus a half or just a half. G prime of C on the left. And let me cross multiply. I'm gonna multiply both sides by X minus C. And then I get that this is less than g of x minus g of c. And let's see. So now if I just analyze my terms here, this is positive. This is positive. That's a half. And therefore, it's positive. So this whole thing is bigger than zero, OK? Which is what we wanted, OK? Okay, well, that's so we're done. So g of x is bigger than g of c, and we're done. So let me just summarize that. Hence, g of x is bigger than g of c, which is supposed to be equal to g of m, the contradiction we wanted. Okay, any questions about the logic of that proof? Okay, so as I said in the homework, you can play around with some examples. It's good to have a good collection of examples that you're familiar with to play with it, to distinguish these different attributes of our spaces. Okay, so the next, if there are no questions about that one, then the next theorem that I want to mention is one that it sort of comes from some distance ahead, but it's, I think, a good indication of where we're headed. So this told us something about functions which are derivatives and how they differ from functions that are merely continuous, okay, which is a stronger condition. And so now I'm going to look at functions which are reasonably differentiable. So they got maybe n derivatives, but we still don't know a lot about them. And we want to compare them to polynomials. And this is something you also did in even in Math 21, where you looked at Taylor polynomials. And we're going to look at Taylor polynomials again, and we're going to look at their errors in two different ways. And so right now we're going to look at one of those errors. And so the idea is to try to understand complicated functions using simple ones. That's going to be the goal of this course in many ways. And Taylor polynomials is a good example of that. It's not the only one, but it's one we're going to use quite a bit. So let me just recall the setup there and the theorem. So Taylor polynomials with Lagrange error. Actually, at the end of the class, we'll find another error term. There are two different ways that we'll look at to find, to understand the error in the Taylor polynomial. So, and sometimes one is more useful than the, and it varies which one you want to use. Okay, so they're both good to have. So we'll see another error, a type of error later. Okay, so that's the, go here. Okay, so let me just remind you of the notation. So we're going to start with a function which is n times differentiable. So if we have some function f is n times differentiable. Okay, so it has n derivatives. Then we write P sub n. Oh, sorry. And let me just take a number here. So C. Okay, so I have some number there about which I'm going to do my expansion. And P, and let me just add C. Sometimes I just write P sub n, but let me just add the C in here just to add all the notation just so it's clear what I'm talking about. So P sub n is going to be our polynomial that we're going to use to approximate our function. That's supposed to be the easier one, but it's going to be look more complicated, but that's just because it's more explicit. Okay, and so it's gonna be the usual Taylor polynomial. So I'm gonna take f evaluated at c, and then I'm gonna take the derivative evaluated at c times x minus c, the difference, the amount that we've moved. So that's our linear term. And then I'm gonna get a quadratic term, which is gonna be the second derivative divided by two squared, I'm sorry, two factorial, not squared, which is just two, and then x minus c squared. So that's where the two comes in, this squared comes in. And then you keep going, and that's what the general term looks like. So the last one is gonna be the nth derivative divided by n factorial times x minus c to the n. Okay, so that's our Taylor approximation to our function. Okay. All right, and as I said, the goal is to see whether this complicated function is well approximated by this simple function. So that's the intuition, is that the polynomial is simple because we understand polynomials. This function f is complicated because all we know is that it has n derivatives and we don't know anything else about it. Okay, so that's the intuition. And so then the error, remainder or error term, is this r. And for now, let me add a lot of subscripts. I don't always put them there. R is equal to R. Let me add an N, because that's how many steps we took. A C, because that's where we're expanding about it. And an X, because that's the value at which we're evaluating it. And this will just be the error F at X minus P N C at X. Okay, so that's our error. And let me just write out the theorem now. So the theorem. It's 8.46. And it says what this error term is. So if we're in the setting up above, so if f is n times differentiable, and we have c and also x, are elements of the domain over which it's defined, then there exists some zeta between x and c. And it says that the error that we're getting here, this r, and CX has a special form, and that's it looks a lot like the next term in the expansion. So we're going to take the n plus one derivative, and we're going to divide, and I left a space here because where we evaluate f is important. I'm going to divide by n plus one factorial. So that looks a lot like this term up here, the next term here. And so I'm going to also get that thing to the n plus one. X minus C to the n plus one, so it looks a lot like it, except instead of evaluating this at C, I'm gonna evaluate it somewhere, and I don't know where. And that's what makes this a hard theorem to use sometimes, is that I don't know where I am evaluating it, what that zeta is. If I can bound it for all zeta, then I'm in good shape. If I can't, then it's less useful. So that's so this sometimes is a very good bound, sometimes it's not as good as our other bound. Okay. Let's see, so I'm out of time. And so next time I will do a few examples. Let me just mention some examples to try and I'll do those next time. So try f of x equals e to the x and f of x equals one over x and try writing those out. They behave differently. And those two behaviors are interesting and they're ones we're gonna focus on later. So they're good examples to look at because they do behave differently, but they're both are useful, one more than the other. Okay, anyway, I'm out of time. And so next time, as I said, I will continue with uses of this mean value theorem, including this proof and a couple of L'Hopital's rule, for example, is the other one. Okay, anyway, I'm gonna turn off the recording and I will stay here for a while if you have.